this is Rob Limo Miller for Slashdot, and we're on the phone with Martin Taylor of Microsoft. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to have the chance to talk to you. I know that we've been trying to get together for quite a few months now, and so I apologize if it's been my schedule that's made it difficult, but I'm glad we're finally getting it done.
Me too. At long last. In any case, let's just jump right in here. We have questions. These are all from readers. And the first one that somebody has, it's from Grayfelt, /user number 521548, and he asked, have you ever used Linux? For what purpose? And what was your personal experience using Linux?
So I actually have a couple of machines here in my office that are running Linux. It's mostly just to take a look at what works and doesn't work. We also have probably about 100 or so servers running, you know, Red Hat, SUSE, Debian, Gentoo, you name it. So, you know, we can take a look at how things work and do some comparative analysis and things of that nature. My personal experience, I used some earlier versions of Linspire and Vandross, and as an end user that's not as technical as some other people, I would say that I found it somewhat challenging on downloading and installing some applications and getting internet access through our proxy server and some of those things. Device plugging in and plugging out, you know, were quite as seamless as I thought they might be. However, I would say the basic user experience of clicking and moving around and things like that, you know, was fine.
Okay, and this is sort of a follow-up. Askadar asks, what is Linux doing right? He asks, I assume you must have evaluated Linux. While doing that, what did you find about Linux that you think is good?
No, I mean, I think a couple of things. One, you know, for the user who really wants to really tear things apart, do things on their own, build their own distributions, and really have, obviously, that level of source code access where they can do things like create a customized distribution with a very, very small footprint with only what they want and not a bunch of other things. You know, Linux is attractive to that class of a user. Linux is attractive to, let's say, a Google, a large company that really wants to build a big server farm. They want to hire quite a few very talented engineers to really tune that on a daily basis and things of that nature. And so I think that when you get to, like, some specific niche areas and those areas where people really want to get deep on their own and take on a lot of the responsibility on their own, you know, I think Linux is attractive in those scenarios. And obviously that's where you see a lot of the market pickup for Linux in those spaces as well.
Okay, let's move on to a different question. This is from your favorite Slashdot poster and mine, Anonymous Coward. This is a question that didn't make the cut, but I assume, do you read Slashdot?
I do. I probably go up to Slashdot at least a couple of times a week, but depending upon the news of the day and the news of the week, I might be on there multiple times a day. So it kind of depends on what's happening in the world. But the same way I would go to MSNBC on big news days and small news days, let's just say.
I understand. But here's an Anonymous Howard's question. When Microsoft seems to tout its desire to facilitate interoperability, do you mean interoperability seamlessly between your operating system and environment with alternative systems such as Mac OS X, Linux, Sun, Solaris, etc., or do you mean interoperability between Microsoft products?
Yeah, I look at two things. I actually call Microsoft products working well with other Microsoft products, personally, I call that integration a little bit. These are defined terms in any Microsoft textbook or Slashdot glossary, I don't know, but...
You don't have a glossary. We're not that formal.
But personally, you know, I say, hey, you know, when I think about Microsoft products working with another Microsoft product, I look at that as more integration. How well do those things work well together? And then I look at interoperability as Microsoft products working with non-Microsoft products. And I think we work really hard to facilitate some things. You can go all the way back, let's say, to our, you know, integrating with Novell days where we wrote our own Novell client. We wrote our own IPX SPX stack to allow us to integrate with Novell servers.
What about now, though?
And then bringing that all the way forward, even now with SMS, our management product, the work that we've done with Ventella to allow us, you know, through open web, I mean, those things, to get to Unix, Linux, and Mac clients, and Mac servers, and Unix and Linux servers, to manage those things, distribute those things. I look at the work that we've done with services for Unix that allows us to integrate with Unix and Linux environments, as an NFS gateway, NFS host, NFS client. So I think that we can generally look around and say, you know, what are the things that we need to do to either partner with third parties, like in the Metella case, or like in the services for Unix case, find ways to interoperate in different scenarios.
This is a question that none of the readers asked, but really dovetails here. Are you willing to cooperate more closely with the Samba project than you have in the past?
No, I think that we're always open to working with people at a variety of different levels to make sure that, again, that we can work well together. Now, I would say that most of the things that we do from an interoperability perspective are driven more by customers and less by industry, meaning that when we have customers saying, hey, we need these two things to work together, and then, you know, and that's where a lot of our, the SMS and Intel partnerships came into play with the Unix and Linux integration. That's the work that we're doing with, you know, as I mentioned, for services for Unix and some of those other spaces. And so, you know, I don't, you know, we won't say no to discussing things with anybody. At the end of the day, we're going to, you know, really work hard to do what customers ask us to do.
All right, next question from Proteus Q. /user number 665382. He's asking about protection against malware, and he's asking you, Martin Taylor, what applications do you run to protect your Windows boxes from malware, you know, viruses, Trojans, spyware, etc., and what do you pay for this protection per year, and how does this cost compare to the cost incurred by other Windows users, and compare to what you would pay for equivalent protection offered in Debian?
Got it. So, let me back. First of all, I actually run, obviously, Windows XP. I run XP SP2. I also have downloaded the beta of the spyware product that we recently, one of our recent acquisitions. And so a combination of XP SP2 and the spyware product that I've downloaded, that's pretty much how I protect and run both my my desktop PC or my laptop that I use here at Microsoft, as well as the three PCs that I have at my house, a very similar configuration.
How much would these add-ons programs cost you? People like you and me, let's face it, as a journalist, I too can get free software from anybody.
Yeah, well,
how much would this cost you as a regular user?
Well, today, XP SP2 is free if you're a genuine or valid Windows XP user, so that's just a matter of downloading. And today, the spyware product that I've downloaded is also a free beta, and we've not announced any pricing terms or plans for that product as of yet. So everything I'm using today is free.
Okay. And this is all the protection you need.
Well, it's all that I have today, and it served me pretty well so far, but I'm hesitant to say it's all that I need, because I think I would be honest to say that I'm probably not as deep in terms of really analyzing everything that I need, but today I have not had any major problems in any shape, form, or fashion with the current configuration. The spyware technology, the anti-spyware technology, I should say, helps me a lot, and that was one of the biggest gaps, I would say, in my desktop profile. And, you know, the spirit of full openness, before we had the spyware technology, when I bought a Dell machine for at home for my wife, we actually, I think there were some Norton tools that shipped with that PC. And again, there was no extra charge for that. It's just, you know, maybe Dell bundled it into the price. I'm not sure. But I've not personally had to go out and purchase or download and pay for any additional security products at this point.
I have a question I'm going to ask you personally that's not from a reader that will segue into the next reader question. Obviously, I run Linux.
And real quick, what do you run? What version do you run, Rob?
I run Nepthys, which is essentially Debian. And right now, the browser I have open is Firefox.
Got it.
So I don't have all of those pop-ups and things. How do you keep from seeing pop-ups?
Windows XP SP2. We have a pop-up blocker as part of that that update to Windows XP. It allows me to, you know, deny pop-ups, but also gives me a pretty functional bar where I can right-click on it when it tells me something has been blocked if I need to see that pop-up, because as you know, many websites might have some type of transaction engine where they do have something that might appear as a pop-up that you need to either fill out information to continue whatever transaction you're driving on that website. And so,
Firefox has that too.
Yeah, so, yeah, but I'm saying yes, what I use it, and that's what I use. Windows XP SP2.
I know, and here's a related question from Doug Dante. He's asking about open source applications helping Windows compete. to what extent are open source applications on Windows helping it to be more competitive versus Linux? For example, he says, I immediately install OpenOffice or Firefox and Thunderbird over a Virgin Windows install.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I heard the initial point saying, how do open source projects help Windows compete? I'm not quite, repeat me the question again, I missed that.
What are you saying? I'll turn his question around from the way he wrote it. He's saying when he installs Windows, he takes a Virgin Windows install and immediately adds OpenOffice.org, Firefox, and the Mozilla-based Thunderbird email program to it. And he's asking, how are these helping Windows to be more competitive versus Linux?
Yeah, I guess I don't look at it that way necessarily. I don't look at it saying, hey, are there, you know, great open source projects that are available on Windows? I think, let me try to paraphrase it and answer it. I think what he's saying is, hey, you know, with, let's say, this new breed of applications that are available on SourceForge, these open source applications, you know, are they making Windows more relevant or, you know, helping it to compete against Linux? Because at the end of the day, Windows and Linux are just operating systems, and, you know, it's really the application stack above that that allow them to be, for people to choose them. Is that a fair way to kind of look at it?
I would say, yes.
And, you know, I would say I don't see it, from that perspective, anything different today than yesterday. We've always had a pretty good, let's just call it an application catalog, and some written by us, most written by everybody else. And so in some ways you can say open source as a development model has just created, you know, a bunch more applications that all can run on top of Windows. And so, you know, and people are always shocked by this. I mean, they don't know that there's literally over, you know, 10,000 projects up on SourceForge for the operating system alone, just for Windows 2000 and Windows XP. And you can, you know, just go up to SourceForge and browse around and just see quite a few applications out there. And that's actually, you know, I'm going to extend the question a little bit if you don't mind.
Now go ahead.
And one thing that really frustrates me a little bit, and you could say this is partly because of us as Microsoft, and hopefully we're getting better here, is when people try to position it as Microsoft versus open source. I really don't view the world that way, and I know that we don't view the world that way. I think that we view the world saying, you know, take OpenOffice. Man, we think Office, the product that we have, is a great product, and we want to make sure that we can show that product and the value that it can offer over OpenOffice.org or over OpenOffice or StarOffice every chance that we get. That doesn't mean that we're anti-open source. It means that we think we've got a great product compared to that one, whether that came from open source model or proprietary development model, the same way we look at Corel or, you know, what you used to look at a MePro or WordPerfect or whatever. And so, you know, and to close on the question, so yeah, there's applications being written for Windows, you know, underneath the open source model, whether they've been licensed underneath the GPL or the, you know, different types of licensing models in open source, and great, God bless them, Godspeed, and it just increases the application platform's availability that we have.
Well, then, I'm going to actually just sort of jump, add a question in here that wasn't on my original list, and I'm actually looking on /dot right now for it again, that you just really led me into, and even if I don't find the exact question, there were over 1,000 comments, you know, on this interview call for questions.
About midnight last night, I was anxiously reading Slash Dot. And I was wondering where you were going to take me, Rob Limo. I read everything as of midnight last night. I read every single thing. I think it was 1,096, I think, was the number I saw at about midnight.
Crazy, crazy. See, you're loved. Everybody loves you.
And I love everybody.
Anyway, the gist of the question, I can't see, there's so many. I mean, I've got to cut to just the +5 questions, but there's 50-some of those. The guy was asking about the chronic FUD, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt thing. If it's true that Windows and Microsoft products are that much better, why do that? What's the point? Isn't that like Ford spending their time knocking GM rather than just boosting Ford?
Yeah, so let me, I think I know what you're referring to based on some of the stuff that I read last night, and so if I can, and you can say I'm cheating, I don't know, but let me kind of try to aggregate about 8 or 10 different postings I saw last night that kind of speak to that. I think they're real.
What's kind of, trying to do here?
Yeah. So, but they're fresh in my mind because I remember them all. So let me tell you kind of what I heard or what I read last night in aggregate. Pretty much saying, hey, why have this Get the Facts campaign? If your products are better, as you suggest they are in different categories, then why do you feel the need to tell people that they're better? Won't they?
Well, no, that's not the question.
Okay.
The question is, why the, and not from you per se, but from some of your coworkers, some Microsoft executives, seem to lash out virulently and with anger against Linux and open source.
Yeah, so, you know, on this one, I actually think that we've made a lot of progress. And so let me, you know, be very open with you and kind of give you what I see as a history. And I love your read on this. As someone who watches us and watches the industry and the things that you do over the length of time you've had. I would say years ago, we did not fully understand. I'm speaking aggregately as a company, did not fully understand Linux and open source. And so whenever you're dealing with something that's a bit of an unknown, I think it's natural to have somewhat of an emotional reaction to that. And also when things didn't quite make sense to you, you thought people might be acting somewhat irrational, then again, it led to somewhat of an emotional response in some ways. And so I think that was the early view. I would also say, you know, that it's a shared responsibility issue because, again, as an avid reader of Slashdot, I would say that many of the folks who participate on Slashdot are somewhat visceral.
Really?
And they're,
what
they're,
might have led me to that belief, sir?
And they're feeling towards us. And so I think that, you know, there was a point in time where we both were maybe kind of at each other a little bit. I think that we've progressed past that to the point where everyone benefits from a more constructive, pragmatic dialogue, to the point where, you know, it's not an emotional thing saying Linux is bad or open source is awful or those types of things, but it's a more of a pragmatic customer-oriented thing that says, hey, here's why I think we've got great value to add here. Here's why I think we have, you know, a better TCO story. Here's why I think that our integration...
Let's move on to a TCO question. That is where you're going to go anywhere.
No, I'm not going to go to TCO. I'm just basically going to say that
I have a question about TCO.
So hold that for 1 second.
Okay.
So I think that we've come a long way from where we were years ago. You know, can we handle everybody on every comment every day? No. You know, but I think in aggregate, and I hope you would agree, what you hear coming out from Microsoft is a different tone than maybe 3 years ago.
A compassionate proprietary software company. Anyway, let's talk about
that. That's a good tagline. Do I have to pay you if I use that in my next PR speeches?
Absolutely. Pay me what it's worth. Namely zero. But here's Railgunner, who's registered user number 554645, wants to talk about Windows TCO versus Linux TCO. And he asks, why do you claim Windows has a lower total cost of ownership, yet you do not add the cost not incurred by Linux and FOSS, free on open source software, of a virus scanner, Microsoft Office on the desktop, or IIS/SQL server on the server, plus the damage that is done by such worms as the Blaster and Slammer?
Yeah, so it's kind of a two-part question. The first thing I would say is, you know, when you go take a look at the total cost of ownership studies that were done both by Forrester, by Giga, by IDC, and by some of the other analysts, they go through the entire solution. Some of those solutions do have, you know, some level of our web server and our application server as part of it, and then some are more just simple workload scenarios. I think that rarely do we say Microsoft gives you lower total cost of ownership. I think what you'll find us really saying when you get to the next level is, hey, for this solution, for this scenario, these set of products compared to these other set of products, Microsoft Microsoft can deliver lower total cost of ownership. So it's really more of a product and a scenario-based thing to take a look at, and then all those elements that come into play there. So that's the first thing to kind of cover up the first part. The second part you mentioned was the notion of how you account for, let's say, some of the security issues from that perspective.
They never seem to be included, right? As near as in the studies that I've read, and believe me, I've been all of Microsoft marketing material. Independent studies. which independent studies done by companies that are supported at some point by Microsoft. However, I must put in the disclaimer that Microsoft is a major advertiser on OSTG, including Blastodon. We thank you for your support.
And those analyst firms are also supported by IBM and HP and Red Hat and other companies as well, because it's kind of the way our industry moves. All that being said, on the second part, you know, we've been looking for ways on how you model that out. How do you model out what you do about security? Yeah, you could always do, let's say, the analysis post-hurricane and take a look at, okay, you know, what were the damages based on this scenario? But that really doesn't give you a view of total cost of ownership or anything like that. And so we've been trying to find a way to model out, let's say, total cost of security or something like that, where you can be somewhat predictive, but it's incredibly hard to do. And so, you know, I'll ask our wide community of Slashdot users, if someone out there has a model where they can do some type of predictive modeling, because that's really what it's about. It's about predictive modeling on what will this cost me over the next 3 to 5 years. How does that look? I'd love any input and guidance, but I know some of the analyst firms are also grappling with this idea as well.
Oh, and most of their people read Slashdot too, so you'll get answers.
So, you know, we'll figure this out at some point in time, but the way to do that is not to say, look, we spent X amount of money due to Blaster, so here's what now the forward-looking costs are. I think the right way to do that is say, hey, what does it cost us to design a secure environment? What does it cost us, you know, to inoculate our environment? What does it cost us from a people resource perspective to build the right redundancy required should something happen? What does it cost, you know, so I think those are the costs you want to somehow model out and look into when looking at that total cost of security from that perspective. But I could be wrong, and I'd love some feedback.
You'll get it. And here's a sort of a question that I pulled out of one of the 1,000-worders that was is cogent, and this is a theme that runs through the TCO studies that Microsoft boosts about, and he says, the Linux geeks really pull in that much more money salary-wise than Windows geeks? Because that's a common theme, that it costs more to hire a Linux admin. And he says, I find this claim hard to swallow, especially in today's economy.
Okay, well, yeah, so this is one where it's just kind of a my word against your word thing that I don't want us to get there, but I just hired 16 Linux consultants for a project I'm doing, and I asked the company that was doing the hiring to actually, I also had to hire 16 Windows and .NET architects as well. No question, the 16 Linux guys I hired cost me a lot more. And it's just a matter of, it's just economics. It's just simple economics. There's way more people out there, and I know this might be unselling for our friendly Slashdot readers, so I don't mean this in a bad way, but in all honesty, there's way more guys out there that know Windows than know Linux. That's just the reality.
It's possible that it was just hard to find Linux skilled people, seriously Intuit skilled people who were willing to work for Microsoft.
No, it wasn't. A third party was hiring them. They didn't know that they were working for Microsoft.
Ah. Okay.
I had a third party go out and say, look, I need you to go hire 16 top-notch Linux architects and 16 top-notch Windows architects so I can do some comparative studies on some work that we're doing. And, you know, no one knew that Microsoft had anything to do with this in terms of, you know, hiring these people to work on this.
Interesting.
And it's less about that and more about the fact that, hey, there's just less skilled people out there, you know, in aggregate in our IT population. And so I think that's the big issue.
Okay, the salary thing does contradict what I see here in Florida. But aside from that, again, like you say, I've seen 2,000 salary surveys and 3,000 answers. So here's another question, very different, about Microsoft breaking its own software from AIM here. There's a username for you. And it says, boom, all these serial number checks, dial home schemes, registration schemes. digital rights management schemes, crippled starter versions of Windows, and now all sorts of anti-piracy checks whenever someone wants to patch their Windows box. Microsoft spends an awful lot of time and effort deliberately making sure their software doesn't work unless the customer jumps through the appropriate hoops. Aren't you worried that this continual and increasingly intrusive process of deliberately breaking and or crippling your own software is going to alienate some of your customers and make them feel like criminals, particularly since the makers of the free software operating systems that you're now competing against have no need of any of it, concentrate all their resources on trying to make the software work?
Okay, so there's a you said a lot there, and I won't kind of parse through the early part.
Bottom line is, here I am running Debian. If I decide I want to add it to three other computers, I just take the CD and slap it on, end of story, and my net cost for a complete desktop is zero, and I don't have to register it.
Yeah.
I can't do that with the one instance of Windows that I do have. I can't slap it into another computer.
Yeah, no, so a couple of things. One, I would say when you look at commercial companies and how they adopt and deploy Red Hat and the commercialized distribution, there is a registration process if I want to install Red Hat on another server and have support for that server. Yes, I can go freely copy it wherever I want, but if I want to have supported servers, as most organizations do, and or supported desktops, there is a registration process. And so I think that we don't look that dissimilar in our model of, you know, asking people to register or at least, you know, somehow verify that this is a legal copy that they're using. The second thing I would say is, you know, one thing that was not quite true in the statement that was made from, I think, AIM here, was that we require people to go through hoops in order to patch those systems. You know, that is not the process today. Today, if you're running a Windows and you need a security patch, you know, there is no additional hoops or things you need to go through in order to install a security fix for your technology today. So that was a little bit, you know, weird as well. And again, lastly, I think we're working super hard to make whatever this process is incredibly seamless. You know, I recently just bought a Dell computer for my wife and at home, and it was literally seconds that it took it to just literally go up to Microsoft.com, verify its ID, and then come back down. And so, you know, I think that, you know, what you're going to begin to see is the continual evolution of kind of the community to commercial approach that's happening in the Linux, or let's call it really the distribution world. Because, yes, you'll always be able to install, you know, Debian or something like that on a million machines if you like. But again, as things become more commercial, as they are with the Linux distributors, you'll see similar processes in place, because that's the only way that they can verify users to then offer some type of support model.
So what you're saying is that you have to register for support with Linux.
I'm not an aggressive Linux user as some of our Slashdot audiences are, but for the servers that I have running and the desktops I have running here, I do have to register those with Red Hat to be in agreement with my Red Hat support agreement.
Okay, well, not everybody uses Red Hat.
Well, no, most commercial customers, again, that I talk to primarily use Red Hat or SUSE as their distribution for commercial customers.
Okay. Let's move on here. We have really two more questions, and this is the last long one. And Jimmy the Geek.
I'm worried already.
He's been around for a while on Flash. User number 180805. And he's saying one of the myths about Windows is that there is a company behind it you can hold responsible for flaws that impact an organization. But, he goes on, if you read the EULA, the End User Licensing Agreement of any Microsoft product, even an update, it disclaims any responsibility whatsoever. They specifically avow that they are not fit for any purpose. So what's up with that?
Yeah, no, this is a broader conversation, a broader question. And let me kind of answer. Actually, I read this question last night as well from Jimmy.
I've read the EULA. I'm the only person you've ever met who's probably read every single licensing agreement for every piece of software he's installed.
There's a couple of lawyers that we have here that read quite a few EULAs as well.
They are sick.
but nevertheless, there's a couple of things. First of all, I would say, really really, when we talk about this kind of accountability and standing behind it, there's a few things that we reference there and where we spend our time. One is, for our commercial customers, you know, of course, how we can provide this level of roadmap, this level of ownership, and all these types of things today on that perspective. Let's just call it from a general support perspective and how that works. I mean, anyone would agree that Red Hat or IBM or even Novell with SUSE, they can only take things to a point at the end of the day, because they don't own the kernel, they don't take the final decision on what's in or what's out of 2.6 or...
Well, no, they can modify it however they want.
No, of course, and then when they do, now you're not, then you could be on a different path or something, or different, you can be forked on a different tree, potentially, based on, you know, what level of mod that they do. And so the point of that is to say, hey, you know, we have that, you know, all the way end-to-end level of ownership where, you know, we can deal with that. The bigger issue that comes up on this accountability issue is around this notion of indemnification and protection. This notion of saying, hey, you know, I can tell any one of my customers if there's any issues from an IP perspective, you know, patent, copyright, trade secret, Microsoft fully takes care of you. And we extend that all the way down to any end user, where that wasn't part of our normal EULA. As of November, we made that change as well, EULA being end user licensing agreement. I think that's where a lot of the issues around accountability come into play, about how does the vendor or how does the distributor or the software provider fully protect and indemnify any customer that's using their software from patent or copyright.
I don't think that's the question that this guy's trying to ask, nor the one that I keep coming. As he says, I can give you the full thing. Open source licenses, he says, usually have the same thing, but those are generally free products. You guys have taken in a couple hundred billion. Plus, we can use the code as we like, so you can't claim any kind of equivalent. So I think what he's talking about is the one big glaring thing that Microsoft, in those EULAs, does not claim this software is a fit for any particular purpose or that it will work, essentially.
Yeah, and so I don't think we claim that software won't work. I mean, I don't know anybody.
I don't claim a will for any human purpose.
Well, no, but come on, Rob. I mean,
I know.
That's a broad surface there. I mean, go read Red Hat's EULA. I mean, Red Hat will pretty much say, hey, we can't guarantee anything with this software either. I read it. I read their filing statement. It's the same thing, right?
I don't know. That's why I use a different variety of Linux, perhaps.
Right, so I think it's impossible for any software provider to say categorically this software can do every single thing that anyone wants to do in the world, right?
But it's always been an amusement part. You almost have to laugh.
It's fine that people can have good sport with it, but, you know, when you get down to the kind of the brass tacks on it, at the end of the day, you know, again, I don't know the software provider that says, hey, our software can do anything in the world that you want to do, so go do it.
Well, there's implied fitness in those products. Like, if I were to go to buy a Jeep Cherokee, I have one. There is an implied fact, both by their sale and the FTC forces them, and many other government agencies, that imply that it's safe to drive on the roads, or reasonably so. Not that it's safe for me to drive drunk with no shoulder harness and go crazy with it 120 miles an hour, but that it's fit for the purpose of being, you know, a transportation device.
Right.
And this is something that, you know, again, that maybe the software industry in general needs to work on, what would you say?
I would actually take this up a notch and say this is not a Microsoft-specific issue, because I don't think we're that unlike any other commercial software provider, with regards to that. It's obviously probably easier to have fun with us at this than anybody else. But nevertheless, your point's fine.
All right, one last question, and you kind of hinted at the answer here. That August, with a Z on the end, asked it very bluntly, are Google morons? Given that TCO is significantly less for Windows than Linux, and he references Z, Microsoft Advertising, and hit the facts literature, are the folks at Google morons for using Linux? These are a lot of computers, and TCO has got to be important in that environment.
Yeah, no, I would, again, that's one of those kind of, let's call them those niche environments where I would say, first of all, let's be honest. Your average commercial company will not pay for the staff that Google has to run their engine. I mean, they hire quite a few very senior, very seasoned technical people to do a very specific function, and they, you know, and from that perspective, so it's very different than your generic IT scenario. Most companies, I mean, Google's a technology company. Most companies are not technology companies. Most companies that I talk to, you know, they're not in business to hire a whole bunch of people to drive this, you know, a stack of servers. They're in business to, you know, if they're an airline company, put people on planes. If they're a soda company, get people drinks. If they're a news company like Flashdot, to get people news. You know, and so anytime that, you know, they can, you know, let's say reduce the complexity of their environment and not have to hire people to go manage and maintain that, that's a good thing for them. And so, you know, I can tell you that, again, that's a different usage scenario in terms of, you know, how they've optimized around that based on your more general purpose scenarios. And so, you know, I'm not going to go on record and say, oh, my gosh, they're crazy. They're going to have an incredibly high cost of ownership because of what they've done. I also won't go on record and say that you could replace all of those servers with Windows servers and the TCO would drop in half. Again, as I said earlier, when we look at total cost of ownership, it's by solution, by scenario, not a broad sweeping, all things related to all people type of a statement.
That's all the questions that I had planned. Are there any that we failed to include that we should have?
No, I mean, I would say, as I read last night, there were some that were that we probably can't even talk about publicly because which was fine. But I have their names. I'll email them myself and answer them. And no, in all seriousness. And you know, and then there were some kind of around this whole get the facts thing. And I do, maybe in closing, want to just talk about that a little bit, if that's okay. Because, you know, let me give you just a little bit of history on kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing the way that I'm doing it. You know, when I joined to try to go figure and work on some of this, you know, I was amazed at, you know, reading Flashdot and reading some other things, just how aggressive people were on, you know, Microsoft isn't this or Linux is this. But it wasn't really grounded in any, it was either grounded in one instance, meaning, hey, you know, I did this one time, and here's why I think one or both or neither are better or good or bad, or it was, you know, it was just not grounded at all in any level set of data. And so, you know, a big push that I wanted was just get the facts and say, hey, let's move this out of an emotional, aggressive discussion, and let's really, you know, kind of have it based more on a practical, pragmatic discussion. And actually, and I even got that from customers. You know, I'm not a deep, deep technical guy. I'm not a deep, deep industry guy. You know, I spend more of my time talking to customers and trying to structure the work that I do based on what they ask. And customers are asking me, hey, you know, help me understand TCO, Microsoft versus Linux for this scenario with these sets of technologies. Help me understand this or that. And that drove a lot of the work that we do. And you know, if you read the details, which I'm sure you have, it's not 100% favorable to Microsoft. There are some things in there that say why Linux is good. There are some things in there that say why the web workload with one of our older studies, you know, gave good TCO for Linux and Apache with against IIS 5.0. So there's things out there, you know, and I've tried to be as transparent as possible on all of those types of things. I mean, even, I mentioned earlier about another company. I used another company to go hire these people. I didn't want to bias the study in any way by people knowing Microsoft was hiring these engineers, and so I asked the third party to hire them. And then, of course, once everything is done, everything is transparent, so you can see everything in terms of the server configuration, who we hired, you know, and how the whole thing works. But so, you know, there's a deep level of transparency that I try to provide. But again, you know, just on that one that I mentioned, I wanted to make sure that they weren't biased because I was hiring them. And so I worked really, really hard to make sure we don't bias these things, and they're as pragmatic as possible. And you know, if there's topics that people think we should undertake, you know, again, I hear from customers all the time, and that's what we spend time on. But you know, I'll keep reading Flashdot, and when people post stuff that's interesting to them, you know, we'll take on some of those discussions and challenges as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, here's an open invitation. That's a good idea. When this is posted, there will, of course, be discussion. Do you have a Flashdot login?
I do not have a Glassdoor login, but I feel bad about that. And so, as of tonight, I will have a... Did it cost me any money?
It costs you just as much as Debian Linux and all the software on my desktop.
Well, that costs me a lot of money to manage and maintain, but that's
No. It's no maintenance at all. I just call them. Leave it alone. It just works.
Okay.
So, in other words, it'll cost you nothing.
No problem.
So
I will get a Glassdoor account tonight.
Well, I'm saying is you're absolutely welcome to jump into the discussion. And I think your participation would be very valuable.
Got it.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. This has been, as always, a pleasure.
Okay, Rob, thank you so much, and I apologize it took us so long to do this, and I look forward to maybe doing this again, okay?
I love it.
Okay, Rob, thanks.